Okay. For today, I've selected the two topics of law and gender. Now, these two topics, I'm afraid I can't do justice to them in 90 minutes, and let alone in 65. I'll try to squeeze today's content into 65 minutes so that we have time for a couple other things. First, perhaps a few exam questions, if there are any, and then the evaluations. So I apologize in advance for the fact that I will not be able to do these topics justice, but I'll sort of try and rush through the material, get it through so that you get a sense of it, and then when you have some time, you can read through the slides again to see if it all makes sense. I've decided to talk about law and gender because they are worthwhile each in their own right, but also because there is an important point of intersection in the sense that law is one of our primary sources for knowledge about how the sexes were treated differently in Anglo-Saxon England. So I've only have a couple of questions that I'll try to address today, which is to start with, what are the roots and principles of Anglo-Saxon law? What function did the royal law codes serve? I will not really talk about what other legal documents tell us about Anglo-Saxon England at any length, but I will ask what legal texts tell us about the role of women in society. And then we move very briefly to the narrative literature and ask how are women typecast in heroic literature and in the elegies? And finally, what do literary texts tell us about Anglo-Saxon notions of gender? In the field of law, there is still a lot of early work that needs to be undone. In the Victorian era, ancient Germanic law was the province of these German scholars who expressly thought of it as Germanic law, isolated from non-Germanic law. The early written law codes, it was thought, reflected an ancient oral tradition that had thrived among the Germanic peoples with no or little trace of Roman contamination. Early Germanic society, it was thought, was held together by the institution of feud. Now, that analysis is perhaps half correct. The concept of feud does play a central role in all the early Germanic laws, and it is an element that we can call Germanic inasmuch as it is absent from Roman and other southern law codes. But the written laws of Anglo-Saxon England and of other Germanic regions, and also those of the regions at large, and those are the only ones, by the way, that have come down to the written law codes for obvious reasons, they were not produced in isolation from pre-existing European laws. Above all, the fact of their having been written down signals that they were inspired by Roman written administration, regardless of their content. Anglo-Saxon laws take their lead from early Frankish laws, and the Frankish laws do take certain cues from southern European notions of government administration. But the early scholars were not entirely wrong. Germanic law does center around the concept of feud. So what do we mean by feud in a legal context? Feud is a legal principle built around kinship and the compensation of injured parties as opposed to fines payable to the community as a whole in the person of the authorities. Examples may easily be found in the sagas of Icelanders. I'll give you one example here. This is a passage from Njáls saga from the 13th century. There was a man named Þórðr. He was called Leysingjason, meaning freedman's son, son of a freedman. His father was called Sigtryggr. He had been Ásgerðr's freedman, and he had drowned in the river Margarfljót. That's why Þórðr had lived with Njáll ever since. Now, when the action begins, we read that Bergþóra, this is Njáll's wife, came to speak with Þórðr Leysingjason and said, "You will go and kill Hallgerðr's kinsman, Brynjólfr." Hallgerðr is the neighbor woman. This is sort of an Icelandic, Real Housewives of Iceland. These two women are each other's greatest rivals. Okay, so this is just to annoy her neighbor that she asks her servants to have the kinsman of this Hallgerðr killed. Brynjólfr rode at Þórðr and struck at him. Þórðr struck back with his axe and cleft the handle in two just above Brynjólfr's hand and immediately struck a second time, and it hit him right in the sternum and went right in. Then Brynjólfr fell off his horse and was dead right away. Thorir looked up Hallgerda shepherd and announced the death by his hand and said where the body was and asked him to tell Hallgerda of the killing. Okay, so I've just condensed a couple of the most important passages or elements of the narrative here. Now comes the response by those who are legally, so to speak, in charge. Now news of this came to the assembly. The assembly being this place where the Icelanders gather once per year. We're talking about the farmers, basically, the nobility, you could say. People like to call it Europe's first parliament, whatever you think of that. And Njaut had them tell it to him three times and then said, more men have now become killers than I expected. Just to remind you, Njaut is the husband of Bergthora, who had given the order for the killing. Then they went to see Gunnar. Now, Gunnar is the husband of Hallgerðr, whose kinsman has been killed. But this is how Iceland works, okay? You have to keep track of all these connections. Gunnar said that it was little loss, but nevertheless, he was a free man. Njaut offered to settle right away. Gunnar agreed and asked that he himself set the terms. He, Gunnar, determined the price immediately and set it at 100 silver pieces. Njaut paid the money at once, and with that, it was settled. Okay, I'm reading this example because it's instructive in a number of ways. Firstly, it demonstrates a network of implicated relations. Thorir is Njaut's servant, who is told by Njaut's wife, Bergthora, to kill a relative of her archenemy, Hallgerðr. Njaut, as the farmer, is here held responsible for the actions of both his wife and his servant. Secondly, note how Thorir, the person who goes and does the killing, goes out of his way to locate the shepherd belonging to the household of the wronged party to identify himself as the killer and instruct him to tell his boss. This is because Icelandic law distinguished between public killing and secret murder. And secret murder was punishable by lifelong outlawry, so it was a much more severe offense. So if you were going to break the law, you had to be smart about it and follow the right procedure. Thirdly, this is an example of an offense settled out of court. Even though the heads of both implicated households happened to hear the news while present at the General Assembly, which is a legal meeting, which is called once a year precisely to address conflicts like this one, with the involvement of all, Njaut and his friend Gunnar decide to settle it among themselves just because they can. Fourthly, because this matter is settled in friendship, as a matter of courtesy, the wronged party gets to set its own terms. So Gunnar decides that this person was worth 100 silver coins. Of course, that couldn't be standard practice, because it's very subjective. Someone in my family is always going to be worth more to me than to you. And so societies with feud-based legal systems needed an intersubjective agreement on the value of life. Such an agreement existed, and this passage even hints at it, when Gunnar says, basically, good riddance, but he was still a free man. The implication being that the death of a free man occasions a certain standard of compensation. That standard is referred to as vergeld, also spelled vergild. Literally, the term means man money or man payment. It refers to the amount a person is worth. If you killed someone without legal cause, you owed the amount of their vergeld to their relatives. Just how much the vergeld amounted to depended on your social rank. In surviving Anglo-Saxon law codes, no vergeld is specified for slaves, meaning either that they could be killed without repercussions, or that such compensation was either too trivial or too variable to be set down in writing. In fact, the excerpt that we just read from Njalsaga is preceded by a couple of episodes in which these two women, Bergthora and Hallgerðr, have their slaves kill each other off. And small sums of compensation are in fact paid, but again, this is done out of court in the friendship between Gunnar and Njaut. The Kentish law of Lochtre and Eadridge from the second half of the 7th century, which is at the top right here, sets the vergeld of a nobleman at three times that of a free man. The West Saxon law of Ine from about 690 at the top left here sets it at six times as much and specifies an extra level in between, which we can assume is something like the lesser nobility, three times the value of a free man. The 11th century text Law of the Mercians at the bottom left here uses precise terms for the different stations, and it also includes a sum of vergold for the king. And the same is true for the 11th century Law of the Northmen, which goes into even more detail and brings religious offices into the formula as well. Both of these latter texts were not officially issued by any ruler, so we treat them as sort of unofficial prescriptive indications. The concept of vergeld was used not only when people were killed, it also became a unit by which other crimes were calculated, sometimes including lesser crimes that was calculated as a fraction of one's vergeld, such as half of your vergeld. So here, for instance, we are told that partaking in a large-scale raid was to be redeemed by payment of one's full vergeld, presumably payable to the victim, although it's not clear to me whether the vergeld gets split up in case there is multiple victims. If a pregnant woman is killed, the perpetrator has to pay her full vergeld, and half of that of her unborn child measured by the father's social rank. We saw earlier that slaves do not have vergeld, but even so, they are counted as someone's property, and so committing offenses against them may still cost you. For instance, in the law of Adalbert of Kent, this is the first written law code of Anglo-Saxon England, issued about 600, and therefore also the first surviving text, even if it only survives in a later copy. But crucially, this law code was issued when Christianity was just being introduced into Kent and Anglo-Saxon England. We find there this stipulation: if a person sleeps with one of the king's maids, let him pay a compensation of 50 shillings. If she is a grinding slave, 25 shillings. The third rank of slave, 12 shillings. So sleeping with one of the king's maids will cost you, but just how much depends on her rank. As we will see later today, this was a measure put into place in order to safeguard the safety of dependents, and slaves were in the protection of their masters. We may consider another clause in the same law. If a free person sleeps with the wife of a free person, let him pay him his vergeld, and hire another woman with his own money, and lead her home to the other person. So, presumably you're paying the rate for the husband's social rank, and it's the husband whom you are compensating. Interestingly, you're also required to purchase another woman and lead her home to him. Here, too, you can speculate about really what is meant. Scholars here actually take for granted that this situation is grounds for divorce, and so you are paying the bride price for a new wife to replace the old one. And if you compare other clauses about adultery, especially in Alfred's time, that suggests that this is in fact the intended reading. But we shouldn't forget that this law was issued about 600 when Christianity was just being introduced and hadn't really become integrated into society. For a long time, it was not unusual to have concubines, and there is some uncertainty about the legal state of prostitution. So I'm actually not entirely sure how to read this clause. Now, the next one is especially interesting. If a person injures someone's sexual organ, let him compensate them with three times the vergeld. And I believe the context, by the way, if you read it within the code, the larger context seems to imply that this is a woman's sexual organ. And then the compensation is three times what you paid if you killed them outright, which had lots of intriguing implications. Are you paying the vergeld for the victim's unborn children? I'm not sure, but at any rate, this clause seems to suggest that sex is more important than life. So this particular law code, that of Adalbert of Kent, is of massive importance for the study of Anglo-Saxon law. First, because it is the first law that's written down in the first surviving Old English text. But let's not forget what was happening at the time. The Augustinian mission had arrived in 597, and Augustine the missionary, was hard at work trying to convert the people. Even the king himself did not immediately convert. Now, this law code opens with a section on offenses against the church with high penalties for such offenses. If that part is in fact authentic, then we may presume that the code was issued shortly after the king's own conversion. If so, this shows the influence of the missionaries on the drafting of law and its promulgation. Because literary production was the province of the church, and so one of the first things the incoming clergyman did was draft a law in the king's name threatening massive penalties for the mistreatment of clergymen. And indeed, it is common for Anglo-Saxon laws to impose higher penalties for killing clergymen than for killing the king, showing the degree to which it really was the church that was calling the shots in the production of law. And it is no different with the law of Adalbert. It's also not uncommon for medieval missionaries to safeguard themselves in this way. For instance, early Icelandic law also begins with a section on Christian law. But just as interestingly, it has often been maintained that the remainder of this particular law code shows no trace of Christian influence, suggesting that that remainder may indeed reflect long-standing Anglo-Saxon practice rather than Roman ecclesiastical tradition. So if the bit about sleeping with another man's wife and then leading a second woman home to them seems outlandish to you, that might be because we are looking here at unadulterated Anglo-Saxon legal tradition, if you'll pardon the pun. As the Icelandic example from Njálssaga demonstrates, the concept of feud makes most sense in societies with little centralized government. As long as there's something of an agreed-upon standard of what a person's life is worth, the implicated parties can settle the matter among themselves. If they cannot come to an agreement, the larger community is asked to arbitrate. That can be done in the person of an objective neighbor or a more formal entity. And historically, that pattern checks out. It is precisely in societies that lack central government that we find law based in feud. But of course, in practice, we often encounter mixed forms as well, as is the case in Anglo-Saxon England. Because it would be misleading to suggest that feud is the only governing principle behind Anglo-Saxon law. Many offenses are punishable by compensation of the victim as well as a fine payable to the king, thus demonstrating a deep familiarity with centralized government as well as with the dynamics of feud. One model for Anglo-Saxon law was the Lex Salica, a Frankish law code almost certainly issued by the Merovingian king Clovis I about the year 500. Like other Germanic law codes, this one too is based around feud in the first instance. Authorities are expected to intervene only as a last resort. The Lex Salica demonstrates a pattern that we recognize in the Anglo-Saxon royal law codes as well, namely these signs that the law code was not the basis of actual legal action. This is most apparent in the fact that its contents are highly selective. There are eventualities for which we know the Franks must have had laws, but they're not here accounted for at all. Accordingly, we may assume that law as practiced in actual fact remained largely unwritten. We speak in this case of folk law. Folk law, like folk tales, folklore, and folk medicine, is stored in communal memory and orally transmitted, and it is therefore characterized by variation and flux. Farmers in Göttingen may agree that a cow is worth 25 shillings, but in Kassel it might be 30. And obviously the consensus on the price of a cow may vary over time as well. So obviously there must be some relationship between folklore on the one hand and the royal written law codes on the other. Presumably, the written codes are a reflection of certain parts of existing folklore. Some scholars assume that the law codes in fact reflect changes to what was already commonly known, though that doesn't necessarily explain why the laws repeat each other so much. But codes of law are undeniably prescriptive in character. As we saw last week in Alfred's preface to his law code, where he says that his counselors had expressed their willingness to follow the law that he had thus set out. As such, the fines and sentences found in the royal law codes may reflect the king's preferences for the sentencing as much as they reflect actual sentences. As the legal historian Patrick Walmott observes, by issuing their law code, the Franks, and therefore also the Anglo-Saxons, employed the Roman format of written law more because they attached value to the format than because they had new things to say. With those caveats, we can say that the royal law codes are prescriptive in intent, leaving their relationship to actual historical practice unclear. They are selective and occasionally internally inconsistent, while they generally reiterate existing law without much change. So we assume that they serve the symbolic purpose first and foremost. Other legal genres, which we may bring together under the nomer of charters, are quintessentially descriptive. The word charter has both a general and a specific sense. Originally, it meant the same as diploma in this context, that is, a legal record of a royal grant of either land or privileges to a religious house, that is, a monastery or a convent. The word charter later came to be used more generally to refer to this sort of record of transmission, also to lay recipients and various kinds of transaction. 200 such diplomas survive in their original manuscript form, and another 900 in late copies, so 1,100 total. But the later copies have the problem that we can't always be sure whether they are authentic, because counterfeiting evidence that land belongs to you can be a very profitable business, and so it seems to have been engaged in a fair bit. Up to about the year 900, so Alfred's death, royal diplomas were produced in the scriptoria of religious houses. So it was the king who issued them, but it was the monasteries that produced the writing. The situation after 900 is unclear, but there is some evidence for the gradual development of centralized institutions for the production of charters along the lines of a royal chancery. Writs are shorter, sealed statements, for instance, of changes in land ownership, intended to be read out in legal gatherings. 120 of these survive. Of the surviving charters, about 70 are wills or testaments. Wills were often produced orally, meaning that we would have had more of them if they had been written down, but this is all we have. The ones that we do have were generally written down well before death. Unlike diplomas, they were often drawn up in duplicate or triplicate so that multiple people could hold a copy. Sometimes this was done in the form of a chirograph. A chirograph is a document written up in duplicate or triplicate on a single sheet, which is then cut in a distinct pattern, such as a wave or a zigzag line, with the word chirographus, chirograph, written across the cut. Each implicated party then got one part of the sheet, and if the agreement ever came up in future discussion, they could be placed together to verify that everyone is still working from the original agreement rather than a counterfeit copy. In terms of gender in law, we'll limit ourselves today to those issues that are most readily accessible due to the fact that they are explicitly raised. So let's start with marriage law. Even though this is a topic that is explicitly treated in a number of law codes, I find it quite difficult to get a complete and reliable picture of the system in consequence of two facts, really. The first is that the law codes assume an audience that needs only the details that were considered more or less variable. Anglo-Saxon law codes have a tendency to avoid stating the obvious, but what may have been obvious to Anglo-Saxon readers is not obvious to us today, so many clauses are difficult to interpret. The second problem is that early scholars sometimes reconstructed a system in some considerable detail, but the system that they came up with was some conjectural, overarching, old Germanic understanding of law based on sources from Lombardy, Germany, Francia, Iceland, Norway, and England. Of course, no such unified system ever existed, and it can be quite difficult to reverse engineer how these early reconstructions follow from surviving sources. More recent scholars will often refer to the original law codes without addressing some of the biggest mistakes made by earlier scholars, which leaves some confusion still lingering. Let's start, therefore, by looking at a primary source. This is an excerpt from a brief text known as Beiwif Manas Yewedunga concerning the engagement of a woman, dated to the late 10th or early 11th century. It starts by having the groom pledge to her guardians that he will maintain the bride. And then we read the following. After that, it has to be clarified to whom the maintenance payment belongs. Let the groom pledge this to, and let his friend stand surety for it. Then, let the groom afterwards make known what he will grant her in return for her agreeing with his will, and what he will grant her if she lives longer than he. If it is settled thus, then it is right that she is deserving of half his property, and of all of it if they have a child together, unless she choose a man again. So, to sort of unpack this, we're looking at three transactions, all incumbent on the groom. First of all, there is something called fosterlehen, translating as maintenance payment. From context and transparent sense, this appears to refer to a compensation for the expense of having raised the bride, and thus presumably due to her guardian. Then secondly, the purchase of the bride as such, that is the bride price, in Anglo-Saxon England also known as the mourning gift, or morgengifu, payable to the bride herself. And then thirdly, the bride's inheritance in case the groom dies before she does, known to us as a dower. Even though the document gives a rather specific guideline for this, it is apparently still separately agreed on ahead of time in what today we would call a prenup or a prenuptial agreement. So you may be wondering, where's the dowry, which is a more familiar concept to us, the idea that the bride brings property into the marriage, usually amounting to her inheritance from her family. This document specifies no such thing. So then, was there perhaps no dowry in Anglo-Saxon England? There may not have been. In fact, if we zoom out and look at history more generally, the direction of payments has fluctuated over the course of the centuries. So Roman society did have dowries, the bride's family essentially paying to get rid of her. Late antique and early medieval society had bride prices where the groom brings property into the union, and then by the high Middle Ages it turns around again and the dowry returns. So this may well be the invisible hand of the market mechanism. If fewer women than men survive childhood in the early Middle Ages, perhaps it makes sense that grooms would have to compete financially to win the hand of a woman. But let's not forget that all prescriptive law codes of the Anglo-Saxon period are suspiciously selective. So just because no dowry is specified doesn't mean that the bride brought nothing into the union. Interestingly, an 11th century law by King Knut stipulates that no money is to be paid for a woman, though the groom may give her something of his own free will if he likes. So perhaps this signals the beginning of a transition away from the bride price and towards the dowry. For bride price, some Old English sources use this term morgengifu, as I mentioned. Perhaps because of the word's suggestive transparent meaning, mourning gift, this concept was popularly treated in early scholarship, where it was reconstructed in more detail than really seems supported by the sources. Some scholars would have us believe that the mourning gift was an optional and initially small gift sealing the marriage contract on the morning following consummation. So in other words, the groom got to try her out one night before committing to the marriage. But there's no source that I know of that to back this up. And at any rate, our text, Beiwif Manas Yewedunga, makes quite clear that the bride price is agreed ahead of time. There's only 8 occurrences of the word morgengifu that I know of anyway, and they're not all of them in the laws either. More widely used is the concept of Mund. Mund literally means hand, which I know is confusing in a German context. It was confusing to my students in Canada when I was teaching German and Old English at the same time. But by extension, Mund, so initially meaning hand, also comes to mean protection and guardianship. And so in law, it refers to the guardianship of one party over another, and also to the sum payable whenever that protection was violated, as in that case where the sexual integrity of the king's slave women is breached that we looked at earlier. Guardianship was practiced over dependents, such as children, perhaps slaves, and freedmen, so slaves that you had released, because ex-slaves don't otherwise have anyone to vouch for their safety. So, if you hurt my child, you owe me compensation for breach of my mund. Breach of the peace is the closest present-day or more or less modern equivalent to this. The obvious question for this week's theme is, of course, in what cases women were subject to guardianship, and more broadly, what the state of women's rights was. Neither of these questions can be answered without qualification. The laws often fail to explain the context of their clauses, leaving a lot open to interpretation. For instance, the law of Adalbert, our earliest law, as I mentioned, has been interpreted to say that all women were subject to legal guardianship, so that it was always the guardian who collected the compensation, right? It could have been their father when they were young and their husband after they got married, for instance. But other scholars believe that women collected their own, and in fact, we saw earlier one clause that at least specifies that they had a wehrgeld. But in general, it is clear that women's rights improved over the course of the Anglo-Saxon period, which, after all, is a long period, spans several centuries, and we shouldn't think of it as a single static situation or culture. So let's look at clauses on women in that earliest law, the law of Adalbert, and then discuss them in more detail. I'll generally read these through first and then talk about some of the implications. So the first one, let the compensation for an unmarried woman be that of a free man. Okay, so clearly there is compensation, there is wehrgeld for women. It's not clear to me whether this means that women of all classes had the wehrgeld of a free man, or whether we should read that differently. Then, for violation of the guardianship of widows of the best, that is the noble class, compensate with 50 shillings. Of the second class, 20 shillings. Of the third, 12 shillings. Of the fourth, 6 shillings. This, by the way, is one good example of how these law codes are very unclear, because people have traditionally read this as support for the claim that all women were under guardianship, right? Because this is the guardianship of widows. But more recently, scholars have said, well, what if this means guardianship by widows over their dependents? And in fact, if you check the amounts, that checks out. So it may well be that this means guardianship practiced by widows. Of the second class, oh, we've had that. If one takes an unayen widow, let twice the mund be paid. This is, again, complicated. What does take mean? Generally, we assume this means abduct. Unayen literally means not one's own. So does this mean if you abduct a widow who isn't yours? A widow is never yours. I don't really know what to make of that. But you could also read it as meaning a widow who doesn't have a guardian. And therefore, she might be in the king's peace, and therefore her mund, her sum for protection, might be twice as much. If one purchases an unmarried woman, let the contract stand if it was done without guile. You'll notice the vocabulary, right? Purchase. If with guile, let her be brought back home, and let him be given his money back. If she gives birth to a live child, let her have half the money if the man dies first. If she wants to live with her children, that means divorce, right? Let her have half the money. So apparently divorce was possible, initiated by the woman. If she wants to have a husband, let her have one child's share of the money. Oh, this gets a bit complicated. If she does not bear a child, let her father's relatives have the money and the mourning gift. If one takes an unmarried woman by force, let him pay 50 shillings to her owner, and then by the owner's consent. If she is financially engaged to another man, let him pay 20 shillings compensation. If she is brought back, although that word could mean assaulted, we don't really know, 35 shillings and 15 shillings to the king. If one lies with a servant's wife during his lifetime, let her be doubly compensated. Okay, gathering all that together, as I said, the traditional view has been that women of the earliest periods reflected in the law of Adalbert, were always subject to legal guardianship. So first they were under the guardianship of their family, then they were purchased by their husband and became their property. The vocabulary used for the transactions in two of these early law codes does indeed reflect a sense of monetary transactions, which is why I've translated it accordingly. A wife is yekeapod, bought. The transaction is referred to as a keap, or purchase. A woman's guardian is referred to as her eigende, or owner. But there is some room for interpretation as well. For instance, the term mund shows up reference to widows, as I said, and so it has been assumed that this is a guardianship practice over widows, but it might just have been their guardianship over dependents, such as children. And in that reading, these clauses emphasize the widow's independence. The law of Alfred, issued almost three centuries later than that of Adalbert, contains some further evidence that women were thought of sort of as property, but it also contains hints that unmarried women could collect their own compensation. Again, let me just read these and then discuss some of the implications. If someone lies with the wife of a man worth 1,200 shillings, let him compensate the man with 120 shillings. Let him compensate a man worth 600 shillings, also with 120 shillings. Let him compensate a peasant with 40 shillings. If someone touches the breasts of an unmarried peasant girl, let him compensate her with 5 shillings. If he throws her down and does not sleep with her, let him compensate her with 10 shillings. If he sleeps with her, let him compensate her with 60 shillings. If another man has lain with her previously, I don't really want to think what's going on here, let half the compensation be incumbent on him. If she is accused, if she is accused of fornication, let her vindicate herself with an oath worth 60 hides or lose half the compensation. If this happens to a woman of noble birth, let the compensation be increased according to the rank of the man. So, first of all, there is here the idea that the husband is compensated at all, as though someone had made unauthorized use of his property. Secondly, there is the interesting fact that the compensation sum depends on the social rank of the husband. These clauses do not go into female personhood at all. But the phrasing is different for clause 11 on the sexual assault of an unmarried woman. This clause repeatedly states that the woman herself is to be compensated. This could conceivably be legal shorthand for her guardian having to be compensated, but because at any rate you imagine that she needs the backing of the guardian and or the authorities in order to persuade someone to pay up. And presumably it is the mund, the price set on her protection, that was supposed to motivate a guardian into action against the offender. But the text does suggest that it is the woman who is compensated. It is not clear, though, whether this is in addition to or instead of the compensation of her guardian for the breach of her protection. The position of women appears to improve in late laws, specifically 5 Adalred and 2 Knut. These are the titles of the laws. In 5 Adalred, from the early 11th century, let every widow of legal conduct be in God's and the king's peace. Probably this means that they are more or less independent, that their protection is vouched for by the king. And let her be without a man for 12 months, then let her choose what she herself wants. So again, it seems that widows had considerable rights in terms of choosing whether or not to remarry. In Knut, it even says, if we look at clause 74, and let no one force a wife or unmarried woman to marry one who displeases her, nor let her be given in return for money, unless he wants to give something of his own will. So this is where, on the one hand, we're told that, yes, women had agency, had a choice in whom to marry, perhaps whether to marry. And in fact, specifically it says, there should not be a payment of the woman or her family, but you can give the woman something of your own free will if you like. On the other hand, 2 Knut does provide severe punishments for sexual offenses by women. For instance, if we look at 73a, if she does choose a man within a year's time, right, so this is the 1 year's mourning period after the death of your husband, then let her give up her mourning gift and all the property that she had through the first husband, and let her next of kin be given the land and property that she had owned. That's pretty severe. And in fact, that King Knut is guilty of an outrageous double standard becomes particularly clear when we look at his provisions on adultery. If a wife commits adultery with another man during the lifetime of her husband, and it becomes openly known, let her come to public shame, and let the rightful husband have all that she had owned, and let her lose her nose and ears. Now, if a married man commits adultery by his own will, let him give her up and do penance for himself before God and men. Right? So, severe punishments for female adulterers, very mild ones for men. And this phrase, by his own will, cracks me up. What do you mean, if a married man commits adultery by his own will? By the way, we may feel all high and mighty judging Anglo-Saxon society for its treatment of women, but let's not forget that German law, until 1997, did not recognize marital rape, right? That's not 20 years ago. So until then, as far as the law was concerned, sexual abuse by your legal partner was just having a bad day. Now, leaving sexual offenses to one side, the improved situation of women in the late Anglo-Saxon period becomes especially clear when we consider how women are treated when their husbands are found guilty of crime. The law of Ina in 690 reads, if a man steals property and brings it into his house and he is caught, then he is guilty for his part, but then there's also the part of the wife, because she has to obey her superior, meaning her husband. If she dares announce under oath that she has not partaken of the stolen property, let only a third of her property be taken away. Okay, so by default, the wife is fully complicit in the action of the husband. Now, if we skip a few centuries down to the early 11th century, we read, if any man bring a stolen object home to his house and he is found out, it is right for the rightful owner to have what he was after, in the sense that if he was going around looking for his lost, you know, iPhone. And unless it has been brought into his wife's locker, she is in the clear. But she is to guard the key, that is, her storeroom and her chest and her case. If anything is brought into it, she is guilty. So, in Knut's England, all married women were apparently equipped with locks and keys. And they are presumed innocent unless the stolen goods are found in those parts of the household to which only they held the keys, which seems a lot fairer to me. Okay, just to sum up. In early Kent, around 600, it seems, although there is some uncertainty there, that women were always under someone's guardianship. Also, we see that they're always automatically complicit in her husband's theft. At the very best, they are only a third complicit. Three centuries later, under Alfred, we read that compensation payable by male adulterers is calculated by the wehrgeld of the wronged husband, and also payable to the husband, treating women somewhat like property. Compensation of unmarried women, though, is payable to the victim directly, it seems. And then by the early 11th century, we find that women are only responsible for certain parts of the house and only complicit if stolen goods are found therein. But on the other hand, there's a very strong a penalty on female adultery, whereas men are punished very lightly. There is no time today to address the position of women in the charters, but let me make two quick observations here. The first one is sort of a general provision, which is that the royal law codes that we've looked at seem to mostly concern peasants, so people that are a bit lower down on the social scale. Charters typically concern the nobility, because it is the nobility who possess land and hand it on to others. So in this context, it's worth pointing out that quite a few charters are either issued or witnessed by women, demonstrating that noble women at least held legal authority. Women also feature prominently among recipients of land. In the early period, they show up as abbesses, whose convents received land, and in a later period, they received land as lay individuals, demonstrating that women were landholders. The fact that they are also found in lists of witnesses makes clear that female oaths carry the same or at least a comparable weight to those by men, and that they played a part in the justice system at all. Between the various languages and genres of old Germanic tradition, female characters are generally understood to be typecast into five functions, roughly. There are the hostesses, there are peace weavers, supernatural creatures, inciters, and witches, not necessarily in that order, and also not all of them appear in all of the languages or genres. The inciter is characteristic of Old Norse prose and verse, where women serve to produce emotional reminders to their male kin of reminders of vengeance due. Some scholars claim to have found upwards of 50 instances of this in the sagas alone. Am I going to take the time? Yeah, I'm going to take the time to read you an example from Njál saga again. Okay, this is about the widow of someone who was recently killed. She went to the far end of the room, unlocked her chest, and took out the cloak that Flosi, the man who's present in the scene, had given Höskuldr, her husband, the one in which he had been killed and that she had saved, blood and all. She came back with it and silently walked up to Flosi. He had finished eating and the tables had been cleared. Hildegunnr, this is the woman in the story, threw the cloak over his shoulders and the bits of blood showered all over him. Then she said, "This cloak, Flosi, you gave to Höskuldr, and now I give it back to you. It is the cloak he was wearing when he was killed. In the name of God and all good men, I charge you by all the powers of your Christ and by your manhood and your valor to avenge all the wounds on Höskuldr's body in death, or else be held in contempt by all men." Flosi thrust the cloak back into her arm, saying, "You fiend, what you want us to do will be the ruin of us. Cold are the counsels of women." And that is, in fact, a common expression in Old Norse literature, and we find similar things in Middle English, and a little bit in Old English as well. At any rate, this is a very good example of the sort of visceral reminders of vengeance that women in Old Norse literature give their men and male kinsmen. Witches and prophetesses, too, are found especially in Old Norse narrative literature, which is not to say that it wasn't a thing in Old English literature, but narrative literature on sorcery simply doesn't survive in from Anglo-Saxon England, and one assumes that the church had something to do with that. Laws and homilies do seem to make a connection between sorcery and female gender. For supernatural creatures, the evidence likewise differs between traditions. In the north, that is, in Scandinavia, there were the Valkyries, Odin's handmaidens who decided which of the slain warriors got into Valhöll. There were also the three fates personified as women, and there is evidence for the Scandinavian veneration of female deities. Anglo-Saxon England here is a bit of a different story. For instance, elves originally seem to have been exclusively male, though there are, of course, other terms for supernatural creatures as well that seem to accommodate women more easily. And some would argue that there is evidence for female deities in the Old English month names. But I want to get to Beowulf. Of the types, the five types that I've just mentioned, scattered across the various languages and traditions of Germanic literature, three may be identified in Beowulf: hostess, peace weaver, and monster. Monster here compares to the supernatural category, but it should be pointed out that femininity is not here presented as a monstrous trait. It just so happens that of the three monsters that we find in the poem, one is female, and yet not entirely so. We won't cover Grendel's mother in too much detail here, but let's run over the basics of her presentation. Her involvement in the narrative is initially indirect. She's never even mentioned until Grendel is harmed. Even then, she's never given a name. Grendel has a name, but his mother is just known as Grendel's mum, essentially, who brings a baseball bat to the schoolyard when her son comes home after a beating. So let's read how she's introduced. This is from Roy Lyatt's translation. It was clearly seen, obvious to all men, that an Avenger still lived on after that enemy, Grendel, for a long time after that grim battle. Grendel's mother, Monster Woman, remembered her misery. Now we skip on, and again this is about Grendel. He, Grendel, went away wretched, deprived of joy to find his place of death, mankind's foe. But his mother, still greedy, grim-minded, wanted to go on the sorrowful journey to avenge her son's death. Okay, so her role is that of avenger. Then there is her appearance. This is my own translation because I didn't like Lyatt's translation for this bit. Sorry, Roy. I heard the inhabitants of the land say, my people and hall counselors, that they saw two such large wanderers of the borderland, foreign creatures inhabiting the marshes. One of them had the likeness of a woman, as far as they could tell. The other vile creature walked the paths of exile in the form of a man, except that he was taller than any other man. The inhabitants of the land named him Grendel in times past. They do not know of a father whether any mysterious spirit was born before him. Now, finally, let's have a look at the impression that Grendel's mother has on the Danes. This is Roy Lyatt again. She reached Heorot, where the ring Danes slept throughout the building. Sudden turnabout came to men when Grendel's mother broke into the hall. The horror was less by as much as a maiden's strength. A woman's warfare is less than an armed man's when a blood-stained blade, its edges strong, hammer-forged sword, slices through the boar image on the helmet opposite. Now, so far, nothing too remarkable. Male primates are generally larger than their female counterparts for reasons of sexual selection and more dangerous in combat because a higher percentage of their body weight is muscle tissue. But something interesting happens when Grendel's mother enters on her path of vengeance. There are these four pronouns that we find that are applied to Grendel's mother that are, however, masculine. It is he who had to inhabit the terror of the water. He will not get away. Go where he will. He who inhabited the waters. This need not mean anything because it happens a few more times in the poem that common nouns, for instance the feminine noun hand, are referred to with a masculine pronoun. But the fact that we have this happening four times with reference to a single individual is remarkable. Some scholars have argued that this signals a transgression of gender rules based on the principle of feud. When someone is murdered, vengeance is the duty of his or her male kinsman. But Grendel appears to have had no male kinsman left. No one, in fact, but his mother. So she takes on a role that is traditionally masculine. Arguably, it is this fact that draws her into the narrative at all. It is certainly clear as soon as she has made her attack on the Hall of Heorot that the Danes are wrong to discount her strength on the basis of her female sex. And in much the same vein, Beowulf has a much harder time defeating her than he does with her son. It seems Grendel's mother transcends the bounds normally thought to circumscribe the female gender. That doesn't work. The role of women as hostesses is found in three female characters in Beowulf, above all in Queen Wealhtheow of Denmark, wife of King Hrothgar, and more briefly also in Queen Hugd, wife of King Hugelac of the Geats in Sweden, and Freyjawaru, that is Hugelac's daughter. The idea of the hostess is that the hostess carries the mead cup around the hall, serving the warriors. Wealhtheow is seen to do this twice, once immediately after Beowulf's arrival from Sweden, and once following his victory over Grendel. In the first instance, she serves Beowulf last of all, and then greets him, expressing her gratitude for his coming to defend their realm. During the feast following the fight, after Beowulf has killed Grendel, she serves Beowulf immediately after serving her husband, the king, so right at the beginning, as if to honor Beowulf for his feat of having killed Grendel. The 2007 Hollywood movie Beowulf, in fact, does an interesting job of depicting the queen's role in the mead hall. In its version, it is an unhappy life in which a sensitive queen is surrounded by drunk warriors and inappropriate behavior. There is no mention of this female perspective in the poetry, but given the ubiquitous references in the poetry to groups of men drinking in the mead hall, it doesn't take a lot of imagination to arrive at this reading. Then finally, there's the peace weaver. This is a term that refers to the practice of giving women in marriage into rival groups in order to secure peace. The term peace weaver is a bit misleading, perhaps, because, at least in the way that I've just described it, the woman, the bride, assumes a very passive role, because it is the patriarchs of both families who decide that a woman is to be given into marriage. Although, of course, the success of the enterprise would also hinge on her ability actively to please her husband and in-laws. Beowulf has two peace weavers, Hildeburh and again Freyjavaru. Let me illustrate the concept using just the example of Hildeburh of the Danes. This is in a subplot of Beowulf, being a conflict that takes place in Frisia between Danes and Frisians. It is told with use of allusions and is not entirely clear what happens, but the sequence may be more or less reconstructed as follows. The first 3 points or so are just assumed, they're not actually told, but we assume that there is some tension between Hnaf's Danes, that's Hnaf is the king or the leader of these Danes, and the Frisians led by Finn. And we assume that that is why Hnaf gives his sister Hildeburh to Finn in marriage in order to secure the peace. Now, when the narrative begins, we find Hnaf and his men in Frisia, so presumably he is visiting his sister, but then the Danes are attacked. There's some reference here to Jutes, and we don't know why. Is this the Frisians, or are these in league with the Frisians? There's a lot of uncertainty here. But here's what matters. Hildeburh's brothers and sons are killed. I think we may assume that this is on opposite sides of the fight, because her brothers were visiting from Denmark. Her sons, presumably, were fighting on the side of the Frisians, because their father is Frisian. During this fight, Finn's forces are so weakened that he is forced to agree to a truce. Now, it is winter by this time, and the Danes cannot return home, and so they have to stay in Frisia with Finn and his men. So they're in for a very tense winter. As soon as spring then comes, the Danes remember their grievances and they kill Finn. And then they go home with as much as of Finn's wealth as they can carry, as well as with his bride, Hildeburh. An interesting aspect of this, of the narrative form of this passage, is that it begins with the observation that this whole sequence of events was very unpleasant to, obviously, the queen, Hildeburh. From Lyce's translation, we read, Hildeburh, indeed, had no need to praise the good faith of the Jutes. Guiltless, she was deprived of her dear ones in the shield play, her sons and brothers, sent forth to their fate, dispatched by spears. She was a sad lady. Then the narrative begins. During the truce, we get a detailed description of the funeral of her brothers and sons as seen through her eyes. It says, then Hildeburh commanded at Hnaf's pyre that her own son be consigned to the flames to be burnt, flesh and bone, placed on the pyre at his uncle's shoulder. The lady sang a sad lament. The warrior ascended. To the clouds coiled the mighty funeral fire and roared before their mound. Their heads melted. Their gashes burst open and spurted blood, the deadly body bites. The flame devoured, most greedy spirit, those whom war destroyed of both peoples, their glory departed. And then finally, once vengeance has been taken, we are told in one breath that the Danes took Finn's riches as well as his queen back to Denmark with them, almost as though the two concepts were interchangeable. So the interesting thing here is that although we get the sense that women are traded off for political ends, the poet is sensitive to the suffering involved for the women being married off. He doesn't go so far as to discuss the question of consent, but he opens the episode with reference to Hildeburh's misery, closes it with reference to her being taken back to Denmark, having lost her husband, sons, and brothers in Frisia. And in between, he vividly describes how she orders her son's corpse to be burned alongside her brother's. That is, in fact, the only active role that she takes in the entire episode. So to me, this doesn't read as a critique of the convention of peace weaving, but rather as a lament for the women who have to undergo this sad fate. That leaves us with just a little bit of time to discuss the texts that I've asked you to read for this week, but I do want to draw your attention to a highly significant cluster of differences between Old English elegies with female voices and those with male narrators. We discussed the male elegies before Christmas. The most obvious members of this category are the Wanderer, the Seafarer, and Deor. Female voice elegies are Wulf and Eadwacher, and the Wife's Lament, which for some reason the translator of the translation that I gave you calls the Wife's Complaint. The Ruin may safely be called neutral gender because the speaker never identifies him or herself. So that's a very small corpus on which to base any generalizations, but since we are in the humanities, we'll do it all the same. The crucial difference between the male voices and the female voices is that the male speakers are in motion. The Wanderer and the Seafarer travel the open sea, while Deor is on the road looking for a new lord. They travel also in their minds. Spatially, because both the Wanderer and the Seafarer speak of sending their minds across the waves in one way or another, but they also travel through time by thinking back to better days, as well as anticipating the end of the world and the hereafter. As Stacey Klein points out in a brilliant article on this subject, it is this motion that allows the male speakers to undergo spiritual development. The speakers in The Wanderer and Deor also speak favorably of heroic culture, the warrior's life in the hall, even if The Wanderer at least ends up contrasting that life with the heavenly afterlife. The women in this week's readings, by contrast, take no favorable view of heroic conventions, because it is such conventions that have isolated them from their lovers. It seems to be the heroic patriarchy that has forced them into isolation, and that does not allow them to travel like their male counterparts. The speaker of Wulf and Eadwacher is on an island, while the speaker of the Wife's Lament is stuck in a cave. Neither do they dwell much on past joy. Instead, they focus relentlessly on present misery. Accordingly, they do not undergo the spiritual development that we find in the male voices, but instead they remain the same, sad, static characters, unable to change the fate handed to them by the men in their lives. So no wonder that they take no favorable view of heroic society. But Stacey Klein points out that they do subscribe to a value of their own that is missing from the male elegies, namely the value of personal relationships. The Wanderer and the Seafarer end up rejecting personal relationships in pursuit of spiritual fulfillment. The Wife and the speaker of Wulf and Eadwacher instead emphasize the importance of interpersonal connections. So this may be a small body of texts, but it gives the appearance of presenting opposing world views. Okay, that was my quick run-through of law and gender. We have 25 minutes left, and in those 25 minutes, I'd like to do two things. I'd like to start by asking you whether you have any questions about the exam. Now, those of you who are not writing the exam but are writing a paper, please stay, because afterwards I'll need you for the evaluations. So you can surely all learn something from this. So let's have it. Any questions? So you'll all score a 1.0 then. So much the better. No questions. If any questions do come to you, don't forget that tomorrow and the day after, there will be two sessions taught by Julia Josfeld. who will recap the entire term for you and answer questions. It'll be an interactive thing as well. So I recommend that you go there, and if that is a less intimidating environment in which to ask questions, then I do recommend that you go. Now, briefly about the evaluation now. I know some of you have gone through this many times, some of you with me, some of you with other people, and some of you will never have done this before. But I do always take the time to explain why we do this and how I want you to go about this. So if you've heard this before, then you must enjoy listening to the same thing again and again because you keep coming back. So there's three reasons really why we do these evaluations. First of all, it is a type of quality control for the university itself. And secondly, it provides me with feedback so that I can improve on the teaching that I do in future semesters, right? So in that sense, both positive and negative comments are more than welcome because I can learn from my strengths and my weaknesses. The third reason why we do this is even more selfish on my part, which is that I don't have a permanent job yet. And when one applies for jobs, one needs to submit evidence of quality teaching. And that is why I have some specific requests of how you go about this. You're familiar with these forms. You just cross a number of boxes, right? Now, that's all right, but the better part is on the back where there's a free text field. And like, it's a lot more informative for me to read what you personally have to say about the teaching than to just look at the average of these boxes. So do the boxes as well, but please write something, whether positive or negative or both, in the free text field. Please do it in English so that I can use these also if I apply to universities abroad. I will hand these out here in the front, and then you can just pass them through. Julia will, let's do that here. Whoops. Julia will collect them afterwards. So just pass them around first, then pass them back to the side. I'll actually leave the room now so that you can do this in full privacy. Now, there's one more detail that I need you to pay attention to, which is I do actually have additional questions as well. These are answered on the form by checking boxes under number 4. Those questions are here, okay? So please take those into account as well. I do believe that's everything from my side, so I will now go away and leave you to your evaluations. Next week, right. Next week's lecture does not count for the exam, but we'll try and make something fun of it. I've called it Practical Old English because we'll talk, first of all, about if you like medieval studies, where else in mostly the English-spoken world can you study medieval studies at various levels, master, PhD? We'll talk about how the Dictionary of Old English is operated, that is to say, how it is written, and we might talk also a little bit about how to use it. We'll talk some Tolkien, and what else can we talk about that is practical? Yeah, all the other things that you can do, the practical uses of what you learn here, as well as possible future career paths. Okay, so I do encourage that you show up, even though it doesn't count towards the exam. Okay, see you then. Thanks very much.